The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. And the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 5, our series for health professions educators. We are so excited to be here recording in person at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine in New Orleans. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Kirzhanovskaya. On today's episode, we discuss successfully navigating negotiations with our guests, Dr. Thomas Chayshelsky and Dr. Gopal Yodavali. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on the show?
Of course, Molly. We are the health professions podcast for all things education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. We have a fantastic conversations with our guests, Dr. Thomas Chayshelsky and Dr. Gopal Yodavali. We cover skills, tips, how to be successful in your next negotiation conversation, what are ways to prepare, and how to approach this conversation.
Dr. Gopal Yodavali is Vice Chair for Education in the Department of Medicine at Boston Medical Center and Associate Professor of Medicine at the Boston University Chobani and Avedisian School of Medicine. He was formerly the IM Program Director at BMC and is currently the Program Director of the Infectious Diseases Fellowship.
And Dr. Thomas Chayshelsky is an Associate Professor of Medicine at Washington University in St. Louis, where he is also the Vice Chair of Inpatient Safety, Quality, and Operations for the Department of Medicine. He's also an Associate Program Director and has held other institutional GMU roles. We're excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine. We are here in person, and it's amazing. And a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you to our Patreon members. If you love the Curbsiders content and haven't joined yet, please consider supporting us and continuing to create this amazing resource.
So without further ado, let's get to it. We're so excited to sit down with you guys here in New Orleans today at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine. We have two great guests today, and we are very excited to talk to you both about negotiation. Dr. Thomas Chayshelsky, do you mind if we call you Thomas today?
That's great.
Wonderful. And could you just give us a one-liner to kind of describe yourself, help our listeners get to know you a little bit?
Sure. Husband, father of three very active children, and in my spare time, I'm also the executive editor of the Washington Manual series, one of the best-selling medical textbooks of all time.
Love it. So. You don't hear a lot about textbooks every now and then.
I know.
So nice to plug that. I appreciate that, Thomas. Thank you. And Dr. Gopal Yodavali, thank you so much for coming on the show. Is it okay if we call you Gopal?
Yeah.
Wonderful. Definitely. Can you share a one-liner that describes you and also include something outside of medicine?
Sure. I'm a father. I'm a father of... My kids are both 19. One is 19 years old. One is 19 months old. I'm a husband, and I'm a huge baseball fan. That's a big part of my identity.
Amazing. Do you have a favorite team?
Well, the Cleveland Guardians are my favorite team, but as any Guardians fan knows, it's good to have a second team, and so the Phillies are my other team.
That's amazing.
Have you been part of the Phillies winning parade destruction situation?
I have no comment.
We in the Bay Area also know something about occasionally having a team and then having a second favorite team in various sports, more recently, too.
Yeah, well, Gopal, I know this is a regular meeting for you to attend, and just want to hear how your experience this year with AIM Week has been and kind of what's kind of some take-homes that you've gotten or what's really impressed you this year.
Yeah, I love coming to AIM. It's one of the highlights of my year. I also go to the fall APDA meeting every year. The biggest thing for me nowadays is to connect with people that I know, reconnect, if you will, connect with new folks. So a lot of my meeting happens more in the hallways and outside the building. And it's been great to do that. But I would say the biggest take home for me right now is all the work around AI. And at the poster sessions last night, I was drawn to those posters and talking to those folks. And that's probably the most exciting part of the meeting so far for me.
That's amazing. Do you have any particular AI take-homes? And then Thomas will go to you, too, afterwards.
Well, it sounds like I should be using AI in all aspects of what I do. So I haven't used it to summarize evaluation data. That's something. I saw a really cool poster about AI and simulation to get people involved even before they start their training program. So these are things that made me think a little bit, and I think hopefully will be things that we do back at Boston Medical Center.
Cool. Yeah, I think we're going to see more and more of that.
100%. And Thomas, what about you? How was AIM for you, and any, you know, surprises, take homes? How's your experience been?
I love this conference. I try to go twice a year as well. You know, it's sort of my professional home here. Lots of like-minded individuals, love the community. I think one of the most rewarding things as somebody in program leadership as an associate program director is seeing former trainees who are now coming up as either associate program directors or program directors, both at our institution here or coming in to the meeting from other institutions as well. Just ran into one of my former residents in the hall, and it was great to see her. And it's so rewarding to see that connection as well.
Totally. It's like the life cycle of residency is, yeah. And training and just seeing people blossom and grow. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Definitely one of the joys of being an educator. Well, you both are here presenting on negotiation. Thomas, you gave a pre-course session on the art and science of negotiation with your co-presenter, Dr. Emily Fondon. And Gopal, you presented Chief Resident Plenary on Negotiation and Conflict Resolution. So I was hoping you could both share kind of what made you passionate about this area and how you decided to share on negotiation. And Thomas, we can start with you.
Sure. As you mentioned, my co-presenter, Emily Fondon, she and I have worked closely together. She's now at a new institution, but we have worked closely together on really lots of conflict and negotiation, and felt that it was one of those things that when we were both earlier in our career, it could have served us to have some of these pearls and insights, which, you know, it fit very nicely within the context of the pre-course. And so, you know, just really based on our own experiences sort of early on as educators in program leadership and things we wish we would have known at the time, really sort of built that the outline of that course.
And Gopal, for you, do you feel like there was something that really made you excited about this content and this topic?
I think I've always kind of been interested in communication and communication in different contexts, definitely communication at work. And for me, it was actually my friend Armand Krikorian. He and I were associate program directors at the same time in the program we trained in. And he introduced me to this idea of negotiation, conflict resolution, directed me to my kind of first few things to read about it. And then he and I developed workshops that we did locally and nationally. And the more I did those, the more I really got into it. So I would say that. And then the plenary that I did was for the chief residence meeting. And in my 12 years as program director, my absolute favorite thing to do was to work with chief residents. Mm. So this kind of married my interest in talking about negotiation and helping people think through conflict, et cetera, and with an audience that I absolutely love.
Great. Yeah. Well, I think it's something that we can all use more of. I think you and I kind of selfishly chose this topic to improve our own skills, but we think a lot of our listeners will appreciate it as well. We'll start with a case from our fictitious hospital, Cashlock Memorial. Laura is a health professions faculty in an educational leadership position who wants to advocate for her residents to receive an increase in their salary, as the city in which they live has a very high cost of living. Her department chair is supportive of her advocacy and has connected her with the hospital financial leadership and HR. Laura is meeting next week with HR and the C-suite leadership to discuss her ask on behalf of her trainees and programs. So how do we even start to think about negotiation basics with Laura as she starts to prepare for this meeting? If she sort of has no background in negotiation, what would you kind of give as a broad overview or a starting point? And Thomas, we could start with you.
I think sort of the main take-home point with negotiation is planning is going to be fundamental to whatever discussion is going to happen. And obviously, we could go into all of the things that she needs to do to plan, but specifically, knowing who she is presenting to is going to be fundamental. When you know who you are presenting to, when you know who you're negotiating with, you can better understand their perspectives and the things that are going to drive them. Some of those things that we'll probably get into a little bit later are what Emily and I called in our session the F factors that matter. And so when you're presenting or you're asking C-suite leadership for raises and salary, they're definitely going to be looking at the finances overall. So that's one of the many things that they consider. The other thing that she will certainly need to consider in the discussion, and this is another F factor that matters for the C-suite, is fairness. Is this something that will be a salary increase will be across all of GME? So knowing, you know, what that ask will look like for everybody is going to be fundamental. And that all goes back to planning and knowing who you're presenting to, knowing what you're asking, and knowing sort of the intricacies to your particular ask. And if it's certainly for salary, knowing, you know, what that is going to do to the bottom line across the board.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, I feel like in health professions education, we don't really get taught any of this. And I feel like Laura is fictitious, but also could be Molly or me. And, you know, in the negotiation basics, we're hearing a lot about planning from you, Thomas. And I wonder, Gopal, are there things that also within the planning time that you would advise Laura to do? Maybe there's a instrument that she needs to look into. Any other kind of tips that you would give for the basics around negotiation?
Yeah, I think to add to what Thomas said, one thing that I would think about is, what is my relationship with the other party? Is it an important relationship? Is it not? That really helps you figure out how you're going to approach things. In this case, it's obviously going to be an important relationship for her. Another thing she has to consider is there a power differential? And I think she's definitely going to enter this feeling that there's a power differential, right? She's speaking to people who oversee her ultimately. So that's important to know. It's also important to know kind of your own tendencies. We've all had conflict before. We've all negotiated before. And each of us approaches it in our own way. So one way that I think you can learn about your tendencies is to use the Thomas Kilman instrument. That's an instrument that puts you in one of five different negotiating styles. Knowing that, I think, is really helpful. And I will say, almost 20 years of working with people in internal medicine, whether they're residents, fellows, faculty, program coordinators, almost always the majority, at least three quarters of my audience, when I have them use the Thomas Kilman instrument, come or fall into the accommodating or compromising category. That's not always the case in other populations, but knowing that is really helpful. And I'd say the last thing in terms of preparing is to, well, there are many things, but the last thing I'll comment on is knowing that she's not alone in this, and recognizing who her allies might be, her chair potentially being one, but maybe others. I think those are things to think about before you enter the room.
Great. I think that's an excellent beginning. And for some of our listeners who may not be as familiar with the Thomas Kilman conflict model, could you just describe what that looks like? And we'll put an image in the show notes so that listeners who have trouble visualizing this on the air can take a look at it. But just so we're kind of all starting at the same place.
Yeah, the Thomas Kilman instrument is basically there's two axes. Imagine, you know, four quadrants, which define five different styles. And one axis is how interested are you in the thing that you want, your goal, that is called assertiveness. And the other axis is how interested are you in preserving the relationship with the other party with whom you're negotiating, and that's called cooperativeness. So when you have those two axes, that defines four quadrants. There's actually five styles, but the styles that the quadrants are defined by are avoiding, which is you're not interested in getting the thing you want, or you're willing to sacrifice the thing you want and sacrifice the relationship for whatever reason. And we can talk about why someone would ever want to do that. Accommodating, which is you prioritizing the relationship and potentially giving up the thing that you want. Competing, which is the opposite of that, where you want the thing that you want so much that you're willing to sacrifice the relationship to some extent. And then collaborating, which is the classic win-win, where you look to get both parties, yourself and the other party, to achieve the interests in the negotiation. That one takes a lot of work, but it's often the one that we should be doing in our day-to-day lives. And finally, right in the middle of all these quadrants is compromising. And that is where maybe you got some of the things that you wanted, you didn't get the other things, and same thing with the other party.
Thank you, Gopal. And I think both of you all touched on this in your workshops and plenary. And Thomas, I don't know if you want to share kind of your thoughts around these particular kind of quadrants and the middle one, and maybe a scenario or a situation that you might use kind of one of these conflict tendencies or tendency might be used in that situation.
Yeah. And Gopal did a great job sort of describing the instrument. And I think, as he mentioned, it really allows you to see what your tendency is when you're dealing with conflict. And I think negotiation inherently is a conflict. It's a conflict potentially with the other person. It's a conflict potentially with the outcome. And so knowing how you respond in a situation where there's conflict is going to be important. It's sort of, it's part of the planning process. So knowing your tendencies. And then I think really importantly is then knowing that you can adapt your particular approach for whatever you're doing. And there's going to be opportunities where competing, where you win, they lose, is going to be the style that you want to use. Maybe you're buying a car, you want the best price. That would be where competing is probably used more than anything. Collaborating where everybody wins more, you sort of expand the pie. That's sort of the aspirational one that we usually want to think about, and certainly the approach that, you know, we would want Laura to use in the scenario that we've been talking about, where, you know, everybody gets a little bit. The relationship is obviously preserved and expanded, and the outcome is beneficial for the hospital and for the residents. So that's certainly, you know, the goal for all of these. And then, you know, as there is the avoiding style on there, and I think we have all dealt with people in our professional lives who use that style probably more than they should, but there is still a role for avoidance. Maybe it's something that doesn't need to be done right now, and it's just going to make the relationship worse, or it's going to, you know, cause more conflict than is necessary. And truly, avoidance of that particular thing at that particular time is the best outcome. So I think really with the instrument itself, it highlights that there are many different styles that are out there. Knowing what your tendency is a really important part of that planning process. And then adapting your style to what outcome you're trying to get, I think, is important.
I might say this is a great transition because, you know, Laura is not at all based on Molly or myself. But if she was to have a tendency towards, or her TKI results showed maybe more of an accommodating approach, are there kind of, you just asked, like, you just mentioned, Thomas, like adapting the approaches. Is there advice that you would give to Laura if she came to you both and said, you know, I tend to be more accommodating. What, you know, is there something I should think about as I go into this planning meeting next week?
And I think that's where, you know, you can start to get into some of the more specific terms with negotiating. So when you're talking to Laura, you know, sort of thinking about the planning and the outcomes, and really, you know, sitting with her and thinking through, you know, okay, what happens if you go into the negotiation and you don't get what you want? Okay, you're residents don't get a raise, you're competing against other residency programs that are offering more, so you're going to attract fewer candidates. So, you know, your outcome of doing nothing or just fully accommodating to what the C-suite is going to tell you, you know, may not be an outcome that you're looking for. So, you know, really thinking through various scenarios and outcome planning, I think, is an important aspect, so that you can really help Laura understand that it is a high-stakes negotiation and that there are going to be consequences if she just, you know, completely accommodates to the C-suite.
Yeah, and that's really great. And I would say sometimes people don't understand that these are learnable skills, and that even if you are an accommodator, you know, you can switch to being collaborating, which is probably what she wants to do in this case. So there's your dominant style, but then there's the style that, you know, under pressure you might switch to, right? And if that ends up being competing for her, that's important for her to know so she doesn't go in there kind of and under pressure switch to a style that's not going to be productive to her. But then kind of coaching her through, okay, now that we know that accommodating may not be the choice you want to make, especially given the alternative, if negotiations fall through, what are some things that would make this more collaborative? And then that gets into a more in-depth preparation. You asked earlier about preparation, but collaboration takes a lot of preparation. And coaching her through that, coaching her in to think about what are the interests of the C-suite and how can you see, help them see that you can achieve those interests for them. Those types of conversations, I think, would be what would be next.
And I think that gets us kind of into the idea of understanding the position and interests of those who are involved in the meeting. How can she actually try to figure out the positions and interests, or I guess figure out their interests and how that informs their positions, especially as that understanding will help her consider a wide range of possibilities and maybe move toward that collaborating style?
Well, I'll say one thing that comes to mind is that having been in Laura's position in the past, I definitely was not in tune with how the C-suite thought about things. And what I thought were priorities were not necessarily their priorities for good reasons, right? We each had our own worlds and my priorities were mine and their priorities were theirs. But it's important to get an understanding of their priorities. So this is where her chair might be really helpful because her chair probably has a much better understanding or other mentors that she might be able to pick their brains before she walks in. I had a good relationship with my chief medical officer, so that was someone that I could speak to before we ended up talking to the CEO or other folks about any changes that we wanted to make. So finding leaders that might understand those perspectives and trying to understand what's important to them and also the fairness aspect, I think, is definitely something that I ran into. And being able to anticipate that that's going to be brought up and being able to say, hey, well, this is why I think it's fair.
I think with, you know, some of these high stakes negotiation, there is so much pre-work that goes into the presentation and the meeting. And really where you learn what the other interests are is really by listening, and it's going to be listening broadly to a wide range of people. So certainly engaging your department chair, engaging with other leaders in the hospital or health system that you're negotiating. Obviously, you know, the direct reports of the C-suite is a great place to start so that you can really understand what their interests are, because it's going to be more than just the bottom line. There's going to be other considerations there, though. To be sure, the financial pressures are going to be important, but you really don't get to the underlying interests without really just listening to a wide range of individuals. And I think that's probably the other best piece of advice to anybody going into negotiations is that preparation, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of perspective gathering, and you get that by listening.
Another thing that I would add to that is most of the time, it's not just one meeting, right? And this might just be the first meeting. So especially if she knows going in that she'll have an opportunity to build her case over time, I think spending that first meeting, doing a lot of listening and doing a perspective sharing, but not necessarily preparing a final ask or coming in strong with what she needs, might be a good approach. I think that if we assume that there's one meeting and we're done, that puts a lot of pressure on us. And if it's not true, then we've done ourselves a disservice. So kind of having a little bit of a long game mindset can be helpful too.
Mm-hmm. I feel like both of you all have mentioned like the power of that preparation, the context building, the active listening. And I think Thomas, in your workshop with Emily, y'all had mentioned kind of the distributive and integrative negotiation approaches, which if I can map them, is it a little bit of like the competing and the collaborating kind of approaches that we talked about earlier? Are there aspects to each that kind of Laura can maybe leverage in this situation? I think, Gopal, you had mentioned like if you know that your tendency is competing, like is there a situation where that would actually be helpful? I know she's not going to buy a car, but maybe, you know, like there's a time in this conversation where that might, approach might be helpful or aspects of that approach. And separately, like the collaborative approach, what aspects could be helpful for Laura as she goes into thinking about this meeting? And maybe it's the act of listening and the what you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. So distributive negotiating is usually something where it's a defined ask. It is more competing. You are trying to win more than the other person. So it's more win-lose than win-win. And it's really sort of a defined point in time rather than a longitudinal relationship. But there are tactics in folks that are distributive negotiators that you can bring in to a more integrative approach. Again, it wouldn't be in the exact same context, but in the integrative approach, you're trying to really expand the pie. So expand the possibilities. So when we say compensation to a resident, are there other things that we can consider that would be beneficial? So, you know, maybe it's a slight salary increase, but maybe it's also better benefits or better, you know, retirement package, those sorts of things that your competitors aren't offering. And so it's something that, you know, expands the pie. It's better for the C-suite in that they're not, you know, laying out a $10,000 salary increase for everybody, but maybe it's smaller than that. So there are tactics that you can use in both of them. And there are tactics in the distributive approach that probably could work in an integrative setting. But what you don't want to do is throw off your more collaborative or integrative negotiation upfront by saying, you know, I need a $10,000 raise for my residents and I won't take anything else. Because then the answer is probably going to be, okay, well, then we're not going to give you anything else and the negotiation will be over. And that's not the approach you want to take. But you can use tactics from distributive where you sort of, you start a little bit higher than your, where you actually want to be. So there are certainly tactics that you can use, but in a professional setting like this, where that relationship is very important, much more opportunity to use integrative methods.
I think this is really getting to this idea of integrative approaches of positions versus interests that we touched on before, because if she says my position is $10,000 raise, that's, you know, if she says that, that's what she wants, but doesn't really get to what she's trying to do, right? Why does she ask for that $10,000 raise? That's something she needs to ask herself before she walks in. The reason she wants that is because she wants her residents to be happy, right? That's one reason. Another reason is to be able to say to during recruitment that we offer something that's appealing to you, right? So maybe if she thinks about those things, like Thomas was saying, the $10,000 might not be the only thing. Maybe it's $5,000, but maybe there's a one-time investment that the medical center can make to improve the resident lounge or something like that, which may also achieve the interest of making residents happy and making the program more appealing, but come at less financial cost to the medical center, right? So it's really important to know what you're asking for, but also know why you're asking for those things. And then part of the preparation is understanding the same thing on the other side, right? What is their position? If their position is we're not giving you $10,000 raises for everybody, we'll understand the interests behind that and then try to help them achieve their interests otherwise.
I think that leads us really nicely into helping Laura define her ask. And you both introduced the concepts of BATNA and ZOPA. And maybe, Gopal, you could start with defining those and sort of thinking about how Laura might use those.
So BATNA and ZOPA. BATNA, B-A-T-N-A, is Best Alternative to Negotiated Agreement. We kind of touched on this a little bit before, but knowing before you walk in the door, what happens if negotiations fall through? Where does that leave you? So for example, if you're applying for a job, what is your best alternative if you don't get that job, if negotiations fall through? Well, if you don't have a job right now, then your alternative is unemployment. But if you have a job, well, then that's your alternative. And if you like your job, that's a pretty good alternative. And knowing that helps you figure out how aggressive to be during your negotiation, right? So it's really important to know your best alternative to negotiated agreement. That's your BATNA. The ZOPA is the zone of possible agreement. So that's basically, for example, if we're negotiating salary and you say the number that you want and I, as the person hiring you, say the number that I think I can give you, there's usually two different numbers. One's higher, one's lower. that defines your zone of possible agreement. And most likely, unless you're really creative otherwise, the final salary will fall within that zone. So there's this concept of anchoring, which is once you say a number, you've anchored at that number. And if you say the lower number, then you've defined the floor for negotiations. Other person says higher number, they've defined the ceiling. All of these are just descriptions of the ZOPA. That's what those terms mean.
And if we were to apply this to Laura, I know we're not talking about Laura's salary, but we're talking about maybe her trainee salary. How would you guide or advise Laura in thinking about her own BATNA and then maybe conceptualizing the potentials for ZOPA? I don't know, Thomas, if you want to give that a shot.
I think with salary negotiations for others, it's always a little bit fraught. But in her case, I think thinking about the BATNA for her shouldn't necessarily be about no salary increase, because if she's facing those external pressures, the folks that she's competing against, just walking away with nothing is probably going to not be a great outcome. So defining what her ask can be so she gets at least something for the residents, I think, is going to be appropriate. Because again, with that sort of walk away, you don't want to be left, in her case, probably without anything. So I think it really comes back to planning, to gathering all of the necessary information. And I think a couple of key points about planning here is bringing data is going to be fundamental to this. So knowing what the salary has been over the past, 10 years or so at your own institution. So you can see, what the growth rate has been. All of those data should be immediately available at that institution. Seeing what the competitors are doing now, both locally and then the other institutions that you feel like you're competing with on a more national level, bringing that information so that you can really have an informed discussion about this. And then I think the other really fundamental thing about these discussions goes back to planning. And I think this was the point that Emily made, that everybody should really take back to their institutions, is planning the ask around when budgets are going to be submitted. So if you ask in the middle of the year, there's no chance that anything's going to happen if the budget cycle is, 6, 8, 9 months, even a year away. So all of these take significant amounts of planning, but knowing when the budget cycles are so that you can time and plan your ask with the C-suite is going to be very important.
That timing piece, I think, was huge for me to also think about, because there's so many things where you could be so ready and have all the data, but if you come in and time it very poorly, it's just not going to land. And I think that's like the piece of planning and preparation that is really well highlighted by your group, Thomas. And I wonder, Gopal, are there other aspects kind of in the pre-work, in the kind of planning of the ask that haven't been mentioned here that are really important?
I think that one thing that we haven't talked about is the fact that in this scenario, the meeting is next week, right? Collaborating, which is definitely what we would advise her to do, is something that, as you've heard now, takes a lot of work, usually takes a lot of time. So she's going to have to prioritize in this 1 week where she's probably on service and probably has semi-annual reviews to do and all these other things. She's going to have to figure out, what can I get done, right? But as Thomas said, knowing that budget deadline and knowing the yearly cycle, you can set aside time, maybe across months to do your planning, right? So knowing that timeline is really important, because it's always good to be collaborative, but it takes time and energy, and you may have to pick and choose what you're going to prepare with. I would say that's one thing that we should name.
And in Laura's situation, if she has already kind of talked with her mentors, talked with some of her, higher ups who can help advise her about this, she's looked into some of the data, and she's kind of going into this first meeting sort of just thinking about putting her ask out there, maybe in a general sense, maybe not a direct number. Should she plan a PowerPoint presentation? Should she, how does she actually frame that meeting, or like what does that conversation look like ideally?
I think there's a couple of aspects to that. So bringing some information is going to be very important. Having a grand round style presentation is probably going to lose the audience. And given that these discussions take a lot of time and usually decisions aren't really made in the meeting in real time, really what you want to do is be able to introduce the problem, have some information that they can see sort of where you're coming from, where your ask is coming from, where you are summarizing the information for them. So if you have, you know, graphs and things like that, and tables with, you know, your salary compared to other salaries, make sure you're summarizing the take-home points for them so that there's no ambiguity. That when you leave, you know, numbers open for interpretation, the other folks in the room are going to interpret the numbers in a way that maybe you don't necessarily fully agree with. And so, you know, summarizing that our salary is X percent lower, having that number out there on the slide itself can be really important. So summarizing the problem, having a brief introduction for your proposal, this is what I would like to do. Again, that's where you're introducing some of those figures. And the overall impacts of that are also going to be really important. So this is what it will mean on a per yearly basis. So providing that information to the C-suite, that's information that they're going to go after anyway. So not telling them doesn't help the negotiations at all. They're going to dig into those numbers anyway. But showing that you've thought through that is an important step in the process. And then really the bulk of the meeting should be spent in discussion, answering questions, dialogue back and forth. So as Emily mentioned, and she's in her role as a chief quality officer, she's in C-suite meetings like this frequently, where folks are coming to her with budget proposals. And what she suggested is, you know, 10 or so minutes of presentation with 50 minutes for discussion rather than like 55 minutes of presentation and 5 minutes of discussion. But the more discussion you can have, the more dialogue, the more back and forth, the more productive the meetings can be.
I totally agree with everything that Thomas said. I think that have your numbers, but don't feel the need to share all your numbers in a detailed fashion. There is an emotional part of this, though, right? There is a conceptual and emotional part of this. And, you know, the more we focus on numbers, the more we may be getting away from that, right? We have to include the other parts, which is, again, why are we doing this, right? And maybe she has data that are not numbers in terms of finance, but maybe she has data from her ACGME survey, right? And she says, hey, we got low scores in these areas. And when I went back and talked to the residents about why that was, there's a lot of kind of discontent around compensation, right? Or there's a lot of discontent around benefits. This is what made me worry about, you know, future surveys, right? Because that may be a dimension that they didn't consider. Maybe that all the other institutions in town raised their salaries, but her institution has not. That was definitely the case for us at our institution a couple of years ago. And that gets to, are we going to be able to still recruit high quality folks, or is this going to have implications for us long term that are more important than numbers, right? And raising that issue. And then now that I'm getting very specific here, but there's a big movement to unionize, right? And if she's going in there asking for a salary increase for her residents, then we know that she's not an institution that has a union, because that's not how collective bargaining would work. But if the institution is not interested in having a union, it's important to raise the implications of not doing some of these things. So, and these are more, they're very real problems that could arise, but they're beyond the figures and they get to kind of the emotions around a decision like this.
Yeah, that was a great segue, actually. I think that, you know, my question was going to be around how do you introduce kind of narrative or other components to the dialogue or to the kind of even the pitch process or the proposal? And how can Laura kind of leverage that story within this proposal or within this meeting, and also kind of potentially control the narrative too, the larger maybe narrative, while introducing a story that kind of pulls on the emotions that you were mentioning, Gopal. Do y'all have any suggestions for Laura around that?
I do think personalizing it to some extent is important. At least in my experience, that's not always what is effective or what folks listen to in C-suite conversations. I think they do listen to the competitive environment. I think they do listen to things like, hey, if we don't want to lower the quality of the folks here, have people start making mistakes, you know, and start affecting some of the other numbers that we all care about. I think that also approaching it as we're all in this trying to make a decision together as opposed to you and I are against each other. And, you know, I think that's really important. And I'll just, you know, call myself out that the first couple of times I engaged in these negotiations, I definitely felt like it was us versus them. And I don't think that was productive. But I do think that if you can establish that we're all trying to work towards these same goals, and this is either how we can get to those, or I worry that the goals that we all care about, we are no longer be able to achieve because of XYZ, that might get people's attention. But you can, and then build your story around that, right? We don't want, we like a hypothetical story. The quality of applicants is lower because we're not offering what others are offering. This means that everyone has to work harder to make sure that, you know, they don't do the wrong thing. And, you know, ultimately there's downstream consequences.
And I think sort of building off of that a little bit, once you have created that narrative, I think then being strategic about finding data that helps tell that story is also key. And again, it's not data that you necessarily need to put up on the slide or put up in front of the C-suite, but be able to refer back to it. And so we in programs have data everywhere, whether it's a schedule, you can get data from that, whether it's ACGME surveys or institutional or other surveys that you're doing, there's data in that. I think interestingly in this, you know, something like post-match survey results could be very interesting. Like, you know, we know that there were 25 people that chose to rank us lower because of the salary and the compensation. That is a very powerful story to tell. So being able to find those objective data to help tell your story, I think, is key. So once you build that narrative, finding those key supporting pieces will help advance the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Great. And what kinds of things have helped you gain these skills in negotiation? Is it mostly just practice, learning from mentors, resources, books? Anything that you would recommend for our listeners to learn more?
Doing it wrong the first couple of times.
Failure. Yes, failure is the most important
opportunity
teacher.
Or first attempt in learning. So, that was, you know, a couple of poor negotiations started my interest. And then as I sort of advanced a bit in my career, having colleagues and peers who are also interested. So that was one aspect of it. And I think there are a lot of great resources that are out there. I did the AAMC GME leadership course, which talked about a number of these things and did a number of these assessments and tools. And I found that to be a really great resource. And then just reading. So Getting to Yes is probably the book in negotiation that's probably the most widely read. I get no take from Getting to Yes, but it's a great, really easy to read resource.
Yeah, I think failure definitely drove me, but also maybe advising folks and trying to help residents, and then that empathy with their situation and feeling like I couldn't help them as much as I wanted to made me want to get better at it myself. And I agree, Getting to Yes is, that's where I started. It's a classic book. Harvard Business Review has really interesting articles on negotiation. And then if you want a little bit of a different take, Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss is a great book. And it's a very different perspective, but I find it very, very helpful too. So I think it's important to read a lot of different sources and then figure out what works for you.
Yeah, his approach to kind of strategic empathy was really, for listeners, it's around, it's somebody who's had incredible experience for hostage negotiation. I remember just like being wowed by some of his points. And I guess I would ask for both of y'all were like failure immediately. That's like the first thing. Were there certain common pitfalls or certain things that y'all saw in those failures that, you know, we can share with the audience broadly, how to maybe identify those and potentially avoid them in the future, or how you all kind of, once the failure happened, you know, moved on to a successful negotiation, maybe changes you made relative to those pitfalls?
Going back to the first point that I made, understanding the interests underlying the positions in the discussions and negotiations, I think that is something that I wish I would have done from the start. And so if that's, you know, one takeaway is always try to understand what the other side, what their interests are, because there's going to be a lot more than their, than, you know, sort of the initial negotiation. There's a lot more that underlies that position.
I think a couple of things come to mind. I mentioned one of them, which is having an us versus them mentality, and that definitely did me a disservice, and that led to some failures. Another is, I think that especially in medical education and as program directors, we feel very passionate about advocating for our trainees. And then we end up taking things personally that maybe we shouldn't take so personally. And I have been guilty of that for sure. So kind of checking my own emotions around it and realizing that I'm not doing anyone a service by coming in strong with a lot of passion and emotion, even if I feel strongly about it. I think that that's another mistake that I made.
Well, thank you both for sharing those. Hopefully we can learn from your mistakes and maybe not repeat them, but I'm sure I will. This has been so helpful and I think a great introduction to negotiation. Do you have some main take-home points for our listeners?
I would say know yourself. And that involves maybe the Thomas Kilman inventory or something similar, but also talking to those around you, people that you trust to give you honest perspectives. And then, as we've talked about a lot, prepare. I think that's so important.
Yep, completely agree. I think that's a great summary.
Fantastic. Thank you both.
Thank you all so much.
Well, Ira, that was so fun to get to sit down with Gopal and Thomas to discuss negotiation. It's really given me a lot to think about and kind of reflect on times when I've tried to negotiate. And one thing that I think I'm going to really try to work on is I tend to be very detail-oriented and very focused on the numbers, and I think I really need to do a better job telling the big story and using some of that narrative approach. So I'm going to try to work on that. What about you?
I love that, Molly. I agree, for me as well. I think one thing, I have taken the TKI a few times, and each time I'm like, oh, is it that? Like, what's my secondary approach? And then this, the part that Gopal
mentioned. Are you accommodating?
I might be combined with some competing and sometimes some compromise. It, you know, changes.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
What Gopal mentioned about understanding kind of your secondary approach and also when you can or need to shift into a different approach, and what Thomas was mentioning about kind of there are distributive approaches that can help in integrative kind of negotiations. And so I think not only do I want to take the instrument again, I also want to think about what are those approaches that I want to potentially use the next time I'm in a negotiation kind of conversation.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible. Thanks to Dr. Karishma Patel for all your help with the background work behind the scenes. And thanks to Dr. Matt Leto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to the team at PodPace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoiblein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And I'm Dr. Ira Krasinovskaya. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you another little nugget of medical edutainment.